Funding for this talk comes from TrialX, connecting patients to clinical trials.
Good evening and welcome to Cure Talks. I'm your host, Priya Menon, joining you from India, and this is Cure Talks' 129th episode, and we are discussing multiple myeloma. My co-host for the talk is Gary Peterson, myeloma survivor and editor of MyelomaSurvival.com. Joining Gary on the panel are myeloma advocates Jack Ilo, Cynthia Chmielewski, and Matt Goldman. Welcome to Cure Talks, everyone. Our featured guest on the talk today is Senior Vice President, Marketing and Communications of Multiple Myeloma Research Foundation, Anne Quinn Young. Welcome to Cure Talks, Anne, and great to have you with us again.
Happy to be here.
The MMRS has built a unique model that provides the only end-to-end solution in cancer research. And this model is based on three interrelated pillars fueled by data generation and integration, collaboration and discovery, and accelerating clinical trials. Integrating this model with precision medicine, MMRF aims to get closer to finding a cure for multiple myeloma. We will be talking to Anne about the details of this initiative and also discuss the results and other developments of the COMPASS trial. For the audience, we'd like to let you know that we will be addressing questions towards the end of the discussion. If you have one for our panel, please post it on Cure Talks website or send it to priya@trialx.com. If you want to ask a question live, just press 1 on your keypads and we can bring you on air to ask your question. I will now hand it over to Gary to begin with the discussion. Gary, you're on air.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity to bring this information to the myeloma patient community. And Anne Quinn Young happens to be an MPH, and I thought that meant miles per hour, but I understand that it really means master's in public health. But as slow as she was getting on the call, it's certainly not miles per hour. But I've met Anne a number of times, and if anything, Anne is the face of the the MMRF. And what I mean by that is that if you know about, and if you happen to be a patient and you know about MMRF, it's usually because you've come in contact with Anne Quinn Young in one of the many forums that she helps to promote and to educate the myeloma patient community. So for all of that, pardon my MPH part of it, you have been more than a guiding light for the myeloma patient community, and we thank you for that. What I'd like to do at this point is, if you could, not everybody knows what the COMPASS trial is or what the MMRF Precision Medicine Initiative is. So if you could please provide an overview for the audience of what COMPASS is, what the trial is, and what are the key objectives of this trial.
So first, again, it's truly, a pleasure to be on the call. Gary, you're so kind. Thank you for those words. And it's great to be on with so many old friends. I'm coming up on my 15th anniversary at the MMRF in the next month, and I think I met Jack pretty soon after I joined the organization. So it really is such a pleasure to be on with so many who have been invested in this disease for so long. As you heard from Priya, we do say that the MMRF has the only end-to-end system in precision medicine and cancer. But what does that really mean? It means that we have a model to make sense of this disease, to make sure that every patient gets exactly what he or she needs to defeat and, perhaps one day cure this disease. I think, we all know cancer is a heterogeneous disease. There are a few exceptions where there may be a single you know, genomic alteration defining the cancer. But for the most part, myeloma and many cancers are very heterogeneous. According to some of the work we've been involved with, it's estimated there's at least 10 or 12 different subtypes of myeloma. So when you're dealing with a disease that is relatively uncommon, sometimes it doesn't feel that way, but, you know, and compared to cancers like breast cancer, prostate cancer, lung cancer, it is relatively uncommon. So to start to map out that picture and define each subtype, you need a lot of data, and a lot of data means a lot of patients. So again, with small numbers of overall patients, it's important to get data on as many patients as possible. So when you see something that only affects 5% of patients, you want as many of those patients as possible, because this could mean the difference between a treatment not working and a treatment giving a patient a very long, long time in remission. So back in 2005, and I promise I won't go year by year because that was a lifetime ago, we launched the Multiple Myeloma Genomics Initiative. And at the time, using technology that existed, it was just to characterize the disease. We worked with the centers that are part of our MMRC, our Clinical Research Consortium, the Broad Institute and TGen, and ultimately it resulted in the first genomic sequencing of the disease. But at the time, we looked at almost 250 patients. It was a single point in time. But not only does myeloma differ from patient to patient, as I know all the expert panel knows, it also changes over time. So every myeloma patient has multiple clones, different types of myeloma cells that, you know, depending on the point of time, some are dominant and some are not. So we knew we needed a longitudinal snapshot of every patient. So with our partners, and, you know, Compass is truly a community effort where we've worked with over 90 different sites to enroll almost 1,200 patients. We're following them longitudinally from the time of diagnosis before any treatment. These are patients who have needed, who have active disease and needed treatment. So smoldering patients were not included in Compass. We sequenced their genome using three different platforms prior to initiation of treatment, and then confirmed best response and at each relapse, and collecting the clinical data along the way as well. All of that data goes into the public domain. All inventions go into the public domain. There's no IP, because we wanted to make sure that in a disease that's still, you know, largely considered incurable, we didn't want to wait until, you know, someone had a discovery or someone wanted to publish a paper. We wanted all of the data out there in the public domain as quickly as possible, so that we had many, many different eyes looking at the data. Is that enough for now, Gary?
But I think you're kind of a very important part of this, and it's because I come from an engineering and business background that, I remember distinctly my boss once told me, he says, you cannot manage that which you do not measure. Mm-hmm. And up until Compass and up until some of these retrospective studies that have been done with some of the data from the national the National Institute of Health, that now we're getting that information. And Compass is a perfect example of, you know, having the data and looking at it like one would do in business, which is, have like the Deming or total quality management approach. So I think that's great. And without it, I don't know how we got much progress. But since you guys have been doing things like this, I think myeloma is one of the few cancers that have shown remarkable progress with a very, very difficult and complex disease. So thank you for that. Along the same line, what is the MMRF Precision Medicine Initiative, and what are the key objectives of this initiative?
So the Precision Medicine Initiative, Compass is really the cornerstone of that, and this relates back to, what Priya had said in the beginning. The model has three interrelated parts. The first piece is building a database, building a data bank of the most comprehensive view of the disease. So we started with the Multiple Myeloma Genomic Initiative, and then we built on that with Compass. And, with Compass and sequencing on these three different platforms, we now have the largest genomics data set of any cancer. So when we put the data into the Genomic Data Commons last fall, we added about 50% to the existing data, which I think there were already like 33 different cancer types on there. So you can see just how much data we're producing. But the data is worthless unless you're moving it toward the clinic. So we felt it was very important to generate the data, share it, but at the same time, we recognize that, there need to be incentives for analyzing the data. There are groups who are, using their own resources to analyze the data, but we've also, formed partnerships with GNS, a company that uses machine learning and artificial intelligence to analyze the data and come up with, potentially new targets, new signatures. We had something really interesting earlier this year where we worked with Harvard Business School, and this is part of what Founder Kathy Giusti is doing as co-chair of the Kraft Precision Medicine Accelerator, is put out a data challenge to open it up to, all kinds of data scientists all over the world, not just focused in myeloma or cancer, to come up with is there a pattern in terms of predicting which patients are most likely to relapse? And interestingly, the one that won the challenge was a police officer who worked in forensics in the Rio de Janeiro Police Department. So, it's amazing that, when you put data out there and then start, offering just small incentives, the incredible minds you'll have on the data. As part of that middle pillar, it's not only putting it in the public domain, the analytics, but also some of the translational work that needs to happen in the lab before you move to clinical trials. And that's the third pillar, is the clinic. So we, conceived of Compass only, to generate data that could that could lead to hypotheses that could lead to better treatments, better, more precise treatments for patients.
Well, that's wonderful, and I understand there's been some key findings from the Compass trial. What are those findings, and how have they changed the life and the care of the myeloma patient?
So, some of the earliest findings, I'd say about a year and a half ago, the data was becoming mature enough to report back on meaningful numbers of patients. So the first, I'd say, large findings were ones that, we were happy were being corroborated with other large studies. So, for example, patients who were started on a three-drug regimen, had a longer progression-free survival than those started on two drugs. And that was also shown through the IFM Dana-Farber study. Similarly, those patients who had an early transplant had a longer progression-free survival than those who didn't. Now, what we're starting to look at, and it is as the data matures, can we figure out, okay, we know when you look at the entire population that this is what's found, but can we drill down and say, this group of patients really only needs two drugs. They would do just as well on two versus three, or this group of patients really doesn't need a transplant, or this group of patients probably wouldn't benefit from a transplant. So, that can be done through some of this, modeling of the data as well, and we're starting to have some of those discussions. We're also finding some new targets and hints at, again, what is predicting some of these patients who relapse early? What does their disease look like, and are there, you know, potential targets for development? One particularly interesting finding is that, you know, I think it's pretty commonly known in the myeloma community, if you have, you know, deletion of 17p, you're a high-risk patient. Well, what we're finding through COMPASS is that, you know, that may show up on FISH, but through sequencing, unless you're missing both copies of your chromosome 17p, then you may not be high risk. I love the analogy that Jonathan Keats of TGen uses to say that, you know, your car has front and back brakes. And if you cut off the front brakes, you know, you're still going to be able to stop the car, maybe not as efficiently as having both, but you can still stop it. You cut off both sets, you can't. And that's really an analogy with 17P. And so it'll be interesting to see how, you know, how that changes the prognosis that patients who may have been told they were high risk, but had they been sequenced, that they may not be. And then, you know, another interesting finding is along the lines of looking at, are there, you know, racial differences in terms of what multiple myeloma looks like. African Americans have twice the risk of developing this disease, but what we've found is that, you know, African Americans have no more, in fact, they may have a lower incidence of high-risk features of the disease, and that when treated with the same, you know, treatments as, you know, European Americans, the outcomes are the same. So then, you know, you go back and look at SEER data to say, okay, well, then why is, you know, the mortality higher in African Americans? It must be something in terms of disparity of care as opposed to something, you know, genetic. So, you know, starting to find very diverse results, whether it's large population findings, you know, new targets, understanding high risk, and just understanding different groups of patients who may have this disease, who may not be participating in many of the other clinical trials that are going on.
Well, thank you very much. There are other trials going on as well. I know that, you know, there's one, I think Takeda is working on it, and they got 5,000 patients, and there was another one with 2,000 patients. Will there be a cooperation between and sharing between the different studies?
Yeah, so, you know, again, for us, all of our data is in the public domain. It's, you know, available by our researcher gateway, so anyone can access the data. We thought when we launched COMPASS that, you know, we would build this data set and then, you know, as you said, you know, we would, you know, work with others to combine them. What's happened is that it's tricky. It's easier said than done. The first challenge is that a lot of these are clinically based. So the amount of genomic data is limited. Actually, yesterday we just had a meeting with GNS, who again is doing a lot of analytics using artificial intelligence for us, and you know they're trying to find data sets to validate some of the findings that they're getting through COMPASS. And the truth is, there aren't many data sets like it. So, you know, we are in active discussions with a number of groups in terms of not necessarily aggregating the data, but if there's a question that a researcher has or that, you know, a patient has, you know, can we pull together relevant data, you know, enough relevant data to answer that question in a statistically significant way? At the same time, we are also, and I know, I think in reading some of the questions from the panel in advance, there's questions about expanding COMPASS. And so we probably wouldn't expand COMPASS as it is, as we set it up today, because it, over time, you know, costs the organization $40 million, a lot of which is coming from, you know, individual donors and patients and their families supporting this work. We also had, you know, a part coming from industry helping to pay for this. But it's expensive. It's 90 different sites, 4 different countries. we're trying to look at ways, how can we do this much more efficiently? And the way technology has evolved, whether it's, you know, some of these blood-based biopsies that are now being used to yield some of the same information that otherwise you need a bone marrow biopsy for, looking at, you know, pulling information from EMRs as opposed to electronic medical records instead of having to, you know, fill out these case report forms. So we are looking at certainly expanding the data set in addition to partnering with others to share data.
Okay, well, thank you. What I'd like to do now is open it up to the panel. Cindy, are you online?
I'm online. Can you hear me?
Yeah, sure can. Your questions?
I am. I do. I have a lot of questions, so I'm going to ask a few of them, and then if someone asks them more, and then if we have time at the end, you can come back to me. Does that sound good, Gary?
Sounds
or
good.
Anne? Okay.
Goodbye, me, Cindy.
Sounds good. I've just been reading so much on the Internet these last couple of days that I have all these questions written down. And so the MMRF has all these initiatives, and we talked a little bit about Precision Medicine Initiative and COMPASS, but you've also launched an initiative for relapsed refractory patients, the Molecular Profiling Initiative. Can you explain that to us?
Yeah, so about a year and a half ago, we launched an initiative to sequence patients outside of COMPASS. And we ended up working with the University of Michigan. It's CLIA grade sequencing, meaning that the results can be used to make clinical decisions. So we started a protocol for 500 patients. We're about halfway enrolled. And actually, the protocol is open to any patient. We've been focusing on relapsed refractory because, you know, there's a greater need there, and the information that can be gleaned is more relevant than, you know, a newly diagnosed or a smoldering patient, because it, you know, what came out of sequencing probably wouldn't change the course of treatment. But in the relapsed refractory setting, particularly for patients who may be running out of options, you know, doing the sequencing, what it can show is that there may be, you know, an off-label treatment or treatment that's used in other cancers that may be relevant. So patients who have, you know, the V600E mutation in BRAF, you know, could go on a BRAF inhibitor. There's also clinical trials like NCI Match, where if you have a certain mutation, regardless of what kind of cancer you have, you could be put into that trial. So, you know, those reports are given back to the doctors, and then, you know, the doctors will review with the patients, are there trials or off-label treatments. We're also planning our own clinical trial, our own multi-arm trial, you know, starting probably with 6 or 8 arms that are for targeted patient populations, depending on, you know, the results of the sequencing.
Okay, cool. And a little bit about precision medicine. It's like my understanding that with precision medicine, you do some type of genetic testing that will identify some driver mutations in a patient. And then from those mutations, you see if there are some treatment options that may be available or what the best options will be. So what types of genetic testing have been part of your trials? How are these tests done? And what types of genetic testing do you think myeloma patients who are not participating in trials should have? And when should they have that?
So, you know, both the Genomics Initiative, COMPASS, and now the Molecular Profiling, they're all sequencing-based efforts. And it's too early, and certainly there are reimbursement concerns to suggest, you know, widespread sequencing of patients. But, you know, I would say if you are a patient who is, you know, relapsing or, you know, running out of some of the available options, you know, you can get in touch with me directly, or our Molecular Profiling Initiative is posted on clinicaltrials.gov. It is open at, I want to say, at least 12, 15 different sites around the country. And so, you know, it does require a bone marrow biopsy, but you can go and have that done, and it may reveal treatments that, you know, either treatments or trials that could be new options for you that you wouldn't have known about had you not done sequencing. Foundation medicine, for those familiar with that, is somewhat similar, but is the it doesn't have all of the myeloma genes that have been identified through COMPASS and some other efforts. So it will give back to you, if you have certain mutations, you know, specific drugs that are used in other cancers. But, you know, and maybe we're a little bit biased because, you know, we picked the best, what we thought was the best platform in working with University of Michigan. But there are some, and some centers have them too. I know Dana-Farber, Sloan Kettering, patients are getting sequenced more regularly, particularly those who are relapsing.
Okay. So basically, in those trials that you were using sequencing type of genetic testing. Okay. And last question for now is, I read a tweet yesterday that in a recent issue of Leukemia, the MMRF used something that was called the MMNet to discover some novel genes associated with high-risk myeloma, and they identified a novel four-gene prognostic signature as part of this COMPASS trial. Can you tell us more about what these novel targets are, and are there any existing therapies that may that we could use on those novel targets?
Yeah, so this is an effort out of Mount Sinai, and, you know, certainly there's three MMRF staff included as authors in the publication. But really, you know, this is what you get when you put, well, you know, Mount Sinai was an active participant in enrolling patients on COMPASS. So as investigators, they had a slightly advanced look at the data. But, you know, it's also in the public domain, and you have people, you know, or groups analyzing the data. So what they did is very similar to what I was describing, or similar to what I was describing with GNS. So they took, you know, a machine learning or artificial intelligence approach to start mapping, you know, networks or nodes to start to predict, you know, in particular, looking at those patients who first relapsed, you know, how can they potentially predict what those patients look like, and how can that be relevant for the future? So, you know, one of the things, as you mentioned, was a four-gene signature. And that's probably, you know, signatures are more prognostic to say, okay, if patients have this signature, we should really look at potentially treating them a little bit more aggressively. But there was a gene, or I guess part of one of the pathways of CDK1 that was part of that signature that we also found through GNS. So when we start planning our multi-arm trial for next year, there is a CDK arm there. You know, some of the other, genes that they found, there's a signature around, you know, translocation 414, you know, that's been long identified, or at least a subset of that is potentially high risk. One of the targets, MMSET, there is a company, Epizyme, that has a drug against MMSET. FGFR3 is another subset of 414, and we have a clinical trial within the MMRC. You know, what really needs to happen, because this was, you know, based on a small number of patients, I think it was around 89 or so who had relapsed early, you know, the data needs to be validated using different data sets, and then certainly some, you know, work needs to be done in the lab to further validate before, you know, for some of these moving into the clinic. But what we hope is that, you know, we're looking at, you know, investing some dollars to give to researchers to take some of these findings, particularly in the area of high risk, which is such an important unmet need in the disease, to take these forward and start to validate these findings and move them toward the clinic. But we also hope that, you know, this is now a publication. You saw it on, you know, you saw it on Twitter that pharma companies will as well, and that they may look at some of these targets and, you know, either have something in their pipeline against them that we don't know about because it's their proprietary pipeline, or, you know, they may have chemists who say, I can make a drug against that. So that's, you know, part of it is what can we drive as an organization, but also publications like this are fantastic because, you know, others can look at them and potentially, you know, have ideas in terms of, you know, either for drug discovery and development.
Okay. Thanks so much, Anne. And
oh, you're welcome.
Larry, why don't you move on? And I have some more questions if we have time at the end.
Okay, will do. Jack, you online?
I am. How are you, Anne?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing well. It's been my pleasure to know you since you've joined MMRF. Long time. So I had a few questions. One just kind of following up on Cindy's, just for clarification. You talked a lot about sequencing in one of the answers to her questions. And I wanted to ask you about MRD testing, which uses the phrase sequencing with respect to next-generation sequencing. But we're talking kind of two different sequencings here, right? You're talking about genomic sequencing, and NGS, I think, is trying to figure out the myeloma pattern sequencing. Can you embellish on that a little bit?
Yeah, with MRD, with, you know, trying to track minimal residual disease, it's basically, you know, trying to find myeloma that may be hiding, you know. So what used to be the most sensitive test to say, oh, you have no myeloma, it, you know, now with things like next-gen sequencing, you can uncover, the sensitivity is so much greater to find myeloma cells that otherwise may not have been detected.
Versus when you talked sequencing earlier, you were talking about genomic sequencing, and that differs in what way?
So in the genomic sequencing, trying to find alterations in specific genes that may, you know, indicate a patient, you know, patients who have a higher risk disease or hints for drug development in terms of new treatments that, you know, new treatments that could be targeted against a specific mutation.
Right. Okay. Thank you. But let me stay on the MRD testing. It's been discussed for many years that when patients are in a complete response, it's unfortunate, but there's a real good chance that their myeloma will come back. And MRD testing has been used to, as you say, get a clearer picture and find that residual myeloma, if indeed it's there. And I know many patients in a CR who would like to get that MRD assessment. And the other day, a patient advocate suggested to me that, well, it's not generally available because MMRF backs next-generation sequencing, while IMF supports flow sequencing, and you know, I don't think that's true, but can you weigh in on any of this?
Yeah, you know, and this is an area that I have not, I guess, has personally been as in tune to as treatments, because, you know, the urgency around, you know, making sure that, you know, patients have new treatments, and, you know, what do you do next after you relapse? So this is like a, it's very, it makes me very happy that we're at the point of, like, how can we find those last myeloma cells? Being
right.
A complete response is a little good enough. But we did convene, MRF convened a meeting on MRD specifically about a week and a half ago with Sloan Kettering. And, you know, my biggest, a lot of it was, you know, very hardcore science and looking at different methods for measuring MRD. My biggest takeaway as a pseudo layperson was it's not about sequencing or flow, but it's really about the sensitivity. And it, you know, we published, we, that group there, MRF plus, you know, a working group that included, you know, so certainly Ola Langridge from Sloan Kettering, Ken Anderson, and many other KOLs and industry a few months ago. And even then it was saying, okay, the sensitivity should be at least either 10 to the, I think 10 to the minus 4. A lot of that meeting was 10 to the minus 6. So what this, you know, newer technology is showing us is that there's, you know, ways to detect, you know, myeloma in much more sensitively than ever before. The question is, what's the right threshold? You know, is there a difference between if you can find a myeloma cell, you know, one in the 10 to the minus 4 versus one to the 10 to the minus 6? We don't know. What really seemed to be the takeaway, too, was that, and this is, you know, where you start to put together some of the COMPASS data versus DFCI IFM, to say that if a patient is MRD negative with at least, you know, 10 to the minus 4, regardless of whether they had a transplant or not, that's okay. It's okay. It's achieving the MRD negativity status. It's more important than the treatment that got them there. And the whole idea around, you know, making MRD a surrogate endpoint is now in myeloma with, you know, new drugs, particularly in the upfront setting. Thankfully, relapse doesn't happen for a good long time. But if we can start to detect, relapse very, very, very early using MRD testing, you know, and retreatment could start and, you know, potentially knock the disease back down again, can we validate that that really is an endpoint for relapse and get it approved for FDA, which will entice more, I think, companies to be involved in drug development for myeloma because they don't feel like they have to wait years and years and years to get, you know, to learn anything from trials because MRD can predict relapse so much earlier. So I don't know if that, I think I might have gone off a little bit of a tangent.
I agree wholeheartedly with you. For MRD to be an objective, the primary objective is important. For MRD to provide direction in treatment is important. So I was going to ask if that's kind of integrated within the COMPASS system.
Yeah, only to a small extent. So we have a partnership with the Italian group centered out of Torino, where they were doing a randomized upfront trial. And, you know, the data was put into COMPASS, and they are measuring MRD. But we don't have any of those results yet because it was, I think, about 2 years ago or so that it launched. We're also, and it's only maybe 100 patients. We're also as part of COMPASS, we were measuring circulating myeloma cells, and that does seem like it could, you know, down the road be a measure of for MRD. Perhaps
yeah.
Not with the technology that we were, you know, using through COMPASS, but as we start planning this, you know, next phase of, you know, data collection, MRD would absolutely be part of it.
Okay. So the other day I was at a meeting and I saw Dr. Asad Usmani give a presentation, and he described the quote-unquote 7 subtypes of multiple myeloma. And he listed the 7 and he talked about what percentage of myeloma are in each subtype and the cytogenetics and different FISH attributes of each and the genes that are elevated in each of the set. And then earlier today you said there are 10 to 12. So now I'm confused.
So
I guess we don't quite really know yet.
We don't, you know, and there are, I can't speak in detail to them, but there are certainly similarities. I mean, what a group that comes up frequently again is this MMSET FGFR3 group. A MYC group often comes up, the MAF group. So there's ones that, you know, even with evolving technology. I think the first subgroups were identified through gene expression profiling, and now, you know, we have these groups based on sequencing. To me, it goes back to we need more data because all of these are based on, you know, several hundred or, you know, in our case, you know, maybe 1,000 patients. And also the data needs to be, you know, brought together in one way, shape, or form. Even I was looking, you know, as Cindy's question about the paper in leukemia prompted me to read the paper more, read the paper more fully. And, you know, even the four gene signature, they ran it against some of the other data sets. And the overlap was like 20%. You know, so we're really far away, I think, from defining what those exact subtypes are because, you know, different data sets, even different groups analyzing the same data set are coming up with different hypotheses. But I'd say in general, you're looking at least 7, you know, and even in there, this leukemia paper from Mount Sinai on the COMPASS, they averaged about 3 clones per patient. You know, we've seen through Jonathan Keats has said 4 to 5. So we're coming up with ranges. But we really do need larger data sets and that are, I'd say, more similar in terms of data collection because the overlap, you know, quite frankly, is not significant yet.
So it's too early to ask if we're really conducting trials yet according to these different subtypes.
Yeah, you know, there's trials more on specific attributes of the subtypes, I'd say. Again, you know, we have within the MRC, you know, a trial of an FGFR3 inhibitor. We have one for BRAF, but that's not really a subtype of a specific mutation. So, you know, to me, it's important to sort out, you know, even the hierarchy of what's important from, you know, mutations versus subtypes and what's really going to inform treatment. Because then you put in signatures, and that's probably more related to prognosis as opposed to coming up with targeted treatment. So there's a lot of work to be done to sort all this out. But, you know, to me, it's exciting that there are a lot of, you know, researchers focused here. And I think, you know, as the MRF has done in the past in terms of bringing groups together to make sense of it all, you know, that's going to become increasingly more important in the future as well.
And then the last question I have is whether or not MMRF is conducting any trials for smoldering patients where maybe that's where treatment could delay progression to myeloma or even be curative at that stage.
So we have one trial open right now. The PI is Irene Gobriel, and it's nivolumab Revdex, which Opdivo, a checkpoint inhibitor approved for other solid tumors. And in the past, the trials are still collecting data, but close to enrollment. We were part of a large DARZALEX trial for smoldering patients and also had one, again, through Dana-Farber, which was ELO or Implicity Revdex. So I think partly here, too, and I've had some, you know, side discussions with, you know, some KOLs, the definition of smoldering and high-risk smoldering, I'm not sure.
Pretty fluid.
May need to be revisited. May need to be revisited because, you know, a lot of those patients, I think, simply have active disease that were called smoldering. And there still may be a subset of patients who are smoldering who should still just continue to be observed because they are at a very low risk of progression in the near future, and treating them, you know, may do more harm than good.
Yeah. Thanks so much, and I look forward to the next time we get to see each other.
I know. Thanks, Jack.
Thank you, Jack. Matt, you online?
Gary,
your
Matt
question.
Had to drop off because of something related to work.
Ooh.
So maybe you could just ask Matt's questions.
Sure, will do.
Yeah.
And if you could, are there plans to reach out to more than 1,000 patients? Effectively, you said 1,200 already, but are you planning on reaching out to more than 1,200?
Yeah, so, you know, as I mentioned, we have Compass is, as it is probably one data set, and it was a lot of work and a lot of money that, you know, I think with how technology has evolved in the last 6 years, we can do it a lot differently. We also have, and so, yes, the simple answer is yes. And in our next, you know, big data collection efforts, we will be, you know, likely more inclusive as well to, you know, have a range from smoldering through relapse refractory. What Cindy asked about before, our molecular profiling initiative, that data also will be merged with or will be put into the researcher gateway together with Compass data. So that's another, right now, about 250 patients worth of sequencing. And, again, for patients who are relapse and refractory and can get to, you know, are in need of new treatment, willing to do a bone marrow biopsy and can get to an MMRC center, you know, not only do you get the report to help you, but your de-identified data would be put into a larger data set.
Okay, thank you. And one other question Matt had was, how are newly diagnosed patients made aware of the COMPASS study or this precision medicine study when, in all likelihood, they've never heard of myeloma when they're first diagnosed?
So for COMPASS, most of the enrollment came through the centers. And I give a huge amount of credit to many patients who were enrolled in the study because what happened was they were diagnosed, you know, say in a community or non-COMPASS site, and then, you know, were referred into a larger myeloma center, and they hadn't been treated yet. And we said, hey, you know, if you're willing to go through another bone marrow biopsy, you can join this study. So a lot of that happened to a lot of patients that they happened to be diagnosed somewhere else and were willing to go through another bone marrow biopsy. But it was largely the centers who you know, made these newly diagnosed patients aware of the study.
Okay. Another question was, has there been any thought about in expanding the scope of the study to look at potential myeloma causation factors? And I think you've already addressed that a little bit.
Yeah, a little bit. You know, I don't know if he meant, you know, epidemiology. We haven't talked yet about that. But we are looking at, you know, things like we are collecting data on heredity and even thinking through, I know there's been a few disparate efforts, but at least in my world, I feel like more and more I'm hearing about siblings and, you know, parent-child, you know, diagnoses. When this had happened before, you know, it was a relative who, you know, sadly long passed away. Now there seem to be, you know, multiple relatives still living with the disease, and I think we can start to learn and, you know, more if we can, you know, identify and collect enough of those individuals, start to understand, are there, you know, in your regular, your germline DNA, are there, you know, factors that could be, you know, look, you know, that they're hereditary from family member to family member. We're also, you know, through this prevention project that we launched, looking at factors that, granted they're, you know, at the tumor level, but that could predict progression from smoldering myeloma to myeloma. And the ultimate goal is to be able to identify those MGUS patients who are likely most, who are going to progress to myeloma versus those who live benignly with MGUS. So, you know, in a number of different ways, certainly, whether it's the, you know, genetic causes or potentially down the road even looking at epidemiology to understand some of the potential causes.
Okay, well, thank you. Priya, at this point, if we could open it up to our callers.
Yes, Gary, we don't have any questions from the audience yet. I think the topic is a bit new. Listeners, if you have a question for the panel, you can press 1 on your keypad and we can bring you on air to ask your question. Meanwhile,
and
Gary, I think
we'll
Cindy has
we'll
some.
Go back around.
Yeah.
We can go back around to Cindy. Cindy had a couple more questions then. Cindy?
Yep,
your
I'm
question?
Here. Can you hear me? Yep.
Yeah, sure can.
Okay. I always worry about that. I don't know why. I guess once people couldn't hear me, that's why. So I guess I spend too much time on social media, Anne, but today I saw a tweet talking about a new immunotherapy initiative that was just launched. There was a press release that today you published, and can you tell us a little bit about this new immunotherapy initiative and how it will work, and are we going to try to match subsets of these myeloma patients that you were talking about with Jack to specific types of immunotherapy, or what's going on?
Yeah, no, I'm glad you brought that up because, yeah, it's very exciting, literally, you know, announced just today. And by way of background, this is an area where I remember the last time a year and a half ago when I, you know, was on here, I think it was you, Gary, was asking a lot about immune therapy and some of the early CAR T study results were being announced. And you know, within the MRF, we'd funded some grant work and engineered T cells. You know, we'd done a few, certainly done trials involving Implicity and Darzalex, but it really hadn't done a ton in this area. And you know, certainly wanted to make not just a little bit of an investment here, but a big one. And so the announcement today was $15 million. Over the next 3 years. And, you know, quite honestly, this started from a roundtable that we held a couple months ago. Kathy, who has stayed in touch with Rick Klausner, who was the former head of the NCI, really, I think, almost back toward the beginning of the foundation, was, you know, involved in Juno and in the company Grail and really saying, it's, you know, there's a lot of questions out there and a lot of lack of standardization for in immunotherapy. Would you help to bring together not just bring together the cancer community to help, you know, identify some of the needs and opportunities? So, you know, we convened a meeting that was heavy on myeloma because we're the MRF, but also included other cancers and came away with that really understanding that there's a lot of opportunities in terms of different treatment modalities, but there's also, again, a real complete lack of standardization. You know, we talked a little bit about, you know, some of the genomic tests in you know, as it relates to immune profiling. There's really no standard tests that are done, and it, really no great understanding of, you know, what are some of the relevant targets either. Certainly, BCMA seems to be emerging as an important one, but the sample sizes are still small. So this initiative, we will at least two components to it. One are putting together these networks of excellence, and this is where we can leverage our end-to-end model again. You know, collecting data, analyzing it, giving them 12 to 18 months to you know, start to understand, you know, what are some important targets, leaving it fairly open, even understanding what are some of the mechanisms of resistance to available therapy. So, you know, we all know that Darzalex is an important therapy for myeloma, but we've also seen patients when they become refractory to it, it's, you know, often leads to a challenge in terms of defining the next treatment. So if we can identify what those mechanisms are and potentially overcome them, you know, we're not only focused on the new therapies, but optimizing the current ones. So that's one big piece of it. The other one is where we'll be announcing probably in the hopefully early fall, a novel multi-arm trial of different checkpoint inhibitors in both a newly diagnosed population, but also relapse refractory. Because, you know, again, we feel like we've done some small investment in the area, but there's tremendous, you know, tremendous promise, and really wanted to put enough money behind it to make a difference.
It sounds like a great initiative. I'm glad you're working in that area, too. And I guess my last question is, I was online today, and I saw this new hashtag. It was the T3 cancer. And when I followed it, I saw Kathy Jinsky speak this afternoon.
Yeah.
And she did a wonderful job there. And one of the quotes said, the more patients understand the importance of their data, the more that they will engage. So can you sum up in a few words why it's important for us to share our data? How can we share our data? What kind of data you're looking for? Just what do patients know?
I'm so glad you watched. I watched it too. So, you know, this could be like a half an hour answer. I'm going to try to figure out how to do it in a small way. I think the most important thing, and Kathy said this on the in the fireside chat with Bill Dalton, is at least, you know, and you know, everyone on this call has done this, but at least identify yourself. You know, there are a lot, and I remember having these conversations with Pat Killingsworth years ago too. How do you find all of those myeloma patients who are out there? Because, you know, going back to my very early comments on this call, you know, we, the community, patients, you know, need each other to kind of identify themselves as, that they're out there. Because as Kathy said too in this film, it's not just your own data. What you understand about your disease can help you a certain extent, but what helps even more is when you understand it in the context of others. So, you know, for us, it's real. The first step is really just for patients to, you know, join the MMRF. You know, you can join the community gateway, but even that will be, I'd say, changing a bit so that there are fewer questions. They're simpler, but they're questions that will help, you know, potentially guide patients to clinical trials or match them with researchers who are asking questions. So I would say to start, just, you know, encourage everyone to, you know, join, you know, register, if you will, with the MRF or join the community, or either directly through our website or through the community gateway. And then just, I'd say, stay tuned over the next year or so, because we will be, you know, rolling out ways that you can give more information about yourself that, again, will help guide you to either a research study or clinical trial. I think what Kathy feels very passionate about is that patients have so much power, really to help themselves, but also to help the entire disease research move forward, and that a lot of patients aren't aware of that. And our challenge now is to build out the systems to make it possible to share more than just who you are and some basic disease information. But that's our ultimate goal.
That sounds good. Thank you so much. I'm done with my questions, Matt.
Yeah, thank you, Cindy. Priya?
Yeah. Thank you so much, Gary. And it's always a pleasure listening to you. Yes. And thank you so very much for sharing all this information with us. I think we almost come to the end of this hour. So thanks a lot for coming and sharing your time and information about MMRF initiatives with our audience. We're actually running a full house today, so I hope people have imbibed quite a bit of information about the initiatives that MMRF is taking for myeloma. Gary, Jack, and Cindy, thank you so much for your participation, and this talk will be made available on CureTalks website. Please visit curetalks.com for details of our upcoming talks. Thank you, everyone.
Yeah, thank you
so
much. And honestly, for anyone, certainly the expert panel knows where to find me, but anyone on the call as well, please, if there's other questions about anything that was discussed or anything that you read about the MMRF, please feel free to be in touch directly.
Thanks, Anne.
Okay, thanks, everyone.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.